tears began to run. I guess I'll start at the beginning in this world of strange design.
This is chaos. Vedant Yepio Kaye here.
Vedant here.
Vedant do here.
Vedant Shosh here.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Look Through the Chaos, the podcast. The podcast that Hugh Hewitt, syndicated radio host, has branded as excellent. I am Dwayne Patterson, at Radio Blogger on Twitter X. This is John Campbell, former congressman from California, at Look Through Chaos on Twitter. That would be THRU, Look Through Chaos on Twitter X. You can read both of our columns on lookthroughthechaos.com. And John Campbell, we got rave reviews from Hugh Hewitt, except there was one caveat to that. He hates the end clips of Siegfried from Get Smart, Bernie Coppell, saying this is chaos. He wants us to scrap all that because he doesn't like that. Now, I am of the mind that we're going to keep that indefinitely because I like it.
And I like it too. And I would imagine Hugh doesn't like it because he thinks it's too light and humorous. And a lot of the topics we discuss are neither light nor humorous. But it is important, I think, as we look at all these things, and particularly since we are looking through the chaos on this podcast and on the website of the same name, that we do include some humor now and then. I would love to say that Hugh isn't old enough to remember the old Get Smart TV show.
But he certainly is.
He absolutely is, since he is 1 year younger than I am, and I loved that show. In fact, I noticed that some of our followers on X are starting to send us things from the old TV show.
Yes, yes, we're getting the graphics of the old Chaos emblem, the old Chaos logo, absolutely.
Which made me look up some of the names, because when Siegfried said, "We don't whatever here, this is chaos, we don't whatever here," lots of times I remember going, "Staka," and I was not quite sure how you spell that. So I was looking it up. Oh my gosh, if you actually look it up on the Get Smart fandom page,
right,
there had to have been, didn't remember this, there had to have been 50 different characters that were part of Chaos.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Not just part of Control, where Get Smart and 99 were, but I had to be 50. I'm reading all these characters. I don't remember all these characters, but I guess they were all there.
Okay. So, no, enough of the chit-chat. The Chaos stuff stays. Sorry, Hugh, you got outvoted two to one.
Yeah, Hugh, if you're listening, that's it. On to serious stuff now. So just
Stick to the issues. Yeah. Okay, so the issues this week. The House of Representatives under Mike Johnson, who is besieged by the rump caucus within the House GOP, is going to go ahead and schedule a four-vote package. And it's not one omnibus bill. It's four distinct individual bills that are all going to be kind of linked together into one series of votes. One bill is going to be a straight aid package for Israel. One is going to go to Ukraine. One is going to go to the Indo-PACOM, which is basically a Taiwanese aid bill. And then a fourth is going to be on, what was the fourth one going to be, John?
TikTok.
Oh, TikTok. They made a change to the TikTok ban, or the forced divestiture of TikTok of the Communist Chinese Party, by giving a longer window by which they have to divest. And that longer period of time is one of the hurdles that was necessary for it to pass the Senate. They made that change in the House. It's expected to pass the House and the Senate. And Joe Biden has said he would sign it if it came to his desk. I have no idea if he will, but he has previously said he would sign a TikTok ban. So, John Campbell, give me the politics. Give me the you were in the House GOP conference for about a decade. Tell us what we need to know about this four-bill package and what you think.
Okay, so first of all, a few things to understand about it. Why it is four bills and what Speaker Johnson is doing. Speaker Johnson wants this to pass. He wants all three of these aid things to go through, Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan, because of the way he's structured and what he's done. we talked about on the last podcast that one of the issues was if you made it a single bill, it was going to be really difficult to pass because there are Democrats who will vote for Ukraine funding, but they won't vote for Israel. There are Republicans who will vote for the Israel funding, but they won't vote for Ukraine funding. There are a lot of Republicans who won't vote for this unless it's paid for, and paid for by spending cuts, not by tax increases. If you put spending cuts in there, probably no Democrats will vote for any of them with spending cuts in there, unless the spending cut was, I don't even know what, it's always hard for me to imagine. I guess it was a defense spending cut. Maybe there'd be some Democrats who would vote for it. I don't know. But so it was hard to imagine a bill you could put together that was actually going to pass. By doing this, I think he pretty much guarantees everything passes. So because there will be enough Republicans and Democrats to vote for Israel, that'll be a lot of Republicans and some Democrats, and it'll pass. The Ukraine funding will pass with almost all Democrats.
Most Democrats and a handful of Republicans.
And some Republicans, right? A bunch of Republicans. The Taiwan bill will pass with, I would say, probably some of each. Probably will make that pass. Then the TikTok ban, which passed before, overwhelmingly, presumably,
that was a pretty bipartisan. That was a pretty it had 300 plus votes for it in the last iteration.
It was, and it'll pass again. And if he gets all these through the House, they'll go over to the Senate. They will pass in the Senate, and Biden will sign them. So what I'm reading is that he's planning on keeping members there through the weekend and having them vote on it maybe Saturday or Sunday. So we will see if that happens or when all the votes come together. But Speaker Johnson has decided that he wants this stuff to happen. And this is a structure under which it will happen. Now, couple other things. That's going to make certain Republicans, a lot of Republicans, actually, reasonable number, unhappy. So we'll get to that in a minute. But I also want to talk a little bit about what's in each bill, is that the Israel funding does include, $9 billion for humanitarian relief. Now, I've always called that Hamas money, which Democrats would not vote for, none of them will vote for any Israel funding without some humanitarian relief. So he put that in there in order to get Democrats to vote for it. But because Republicans had pushed back so hard on that money for Hamas, it specifically says the money cannot be routed through the United Nations Relief and Works Agency or the UNRWA, which got a lot of the other funding,
We
know is actually run by terrorist organizations. Part of the United,
certainly infiltrate,
right?
Certainly infiltrated by.
Right. And a lot of this relief money was handled by actual members of Hamas, Hezbollah, et cetera. So Republicans weren't going to go if he did that. So he put both those in, and both those supposedly should ameliorate some Republicans. So they'll go ahead and choke down the $9 billion humanitarian relief, and Democrats will choke down the $26 billion for Israel, as long as for Israel, which is basically military aid, as long as it has the humanitarian relief. So these are some of the things that he did. The Ukraine funding supposedly has more oversight. Some of it, $23 billion, it's $61 billion for Ukraine. $23 billion of that is specifically for weapons, just bullets, basically, and drones and tanks, whatever. $10 billion of it is repayment. There's oversight of the funds, and $10 billion is supposed to get repaid. So, you know, there's a lot of Republicans have had issues with the oversight. So he supposedly put some oversight in there so they can't spend it on corruption. That you can never stop that, but that's in there.
Okay, let's stop for a second.
Okay.
We'll get through all four, but I don't want to completely confuse people about what the first one was. If you're a sitting congressman, if you're in the chamber still, how do you vote on the Israel and the Ukraine?
Let me just get to the third one. The third one is Taiwan. It's the smallest. It's $8 billion. Some of it is actually for U.S. military to beef up the presence in and around Taiwan, particularly with submarines. And then some of it is direct aid, military aid to Taiwan. Okay, so those three bills. TikTok's separate.
It's sort of separate.
We'll talk about that in a second. If I was in Congress and I was sitting there today, and if Mr. Hewitt is listening to this, because I just read his tweet before we came to start to record this, he would be mad at me and probably support somebody in a primary against me. I would vote no on all three. And the reason I would vote no on all three is that they're not paid for. The total of this is almost $100 billion. It's almost $95 billion. And I've been a fiscal hawk my whole career, my whole life. It's almost what got me into politics back in the end of the 90s. And it just has gotten worse and worse and worse. And at some point, we just have to stop making it worse. Look, it is so bad that, as we've discussed, you know, if you cut Social Security payments in half, you don't even solve the deficit. I mean, it's so bad that it's really hard to solve. It will be really hard to solve over a 10-year period, not to mention once. But the first thing we need to do is stop just spending a bunch more money without paying for it. Now, to give you an idea of how much this is, I hate the Department of Education. I would imagine most everybody listening to this podcast is not a fan of the Department of Education. I would like to eliminate it. I would like to see it go away. The only federal schools that exist are schools on military bases for the children of people in the military. And those schools, by the way, are not run by the Department of Education, fortunately. They are run by the Department of Defense. So the Department of Education has no schools. So there's not a teacher. Well, I'm sure there's former teachers there, but nobody in the Department of Education is educating anybody. It is a giant bureaucracy. The budget that Biden has requested for the next fiscal year on the Department of Education is $85 billion. It's less than this bill. So if you eliminated the whole Department of Education, it wouldn't even pay for this bill. And so all of this bill. So $100 billion used to be a lot of money. Even in the federal government, it used to be a lot of money. I remember when Pelosi called us back in August, in the middle of summer, to vote on $30 billion and every single Republican, new spending. And every single Republican voted no, every single one, because we didn't want to spend another $30 billion. And this is another $100 billion on top of all, every bill that is out there, it seems, is more money. And at some point, you got to say, no, pay for it. And this is not paid for now. And here's why. And that's part of the reason, going back to what I said, Speaker Johnson wants this to pass. If he pays for it with spending cuts, Democrats won't vote for any of them. If you paid for it with tax increases, Republicans won't vote for any of them. So therein lies the problem. I often used to say when I was in Congress that there was a constituency for every dollar in the federal government spending, big constituencies for every one of them. But the constituency for the deficit was amorphous. You know, there's people like me, but it's not, and there's many of you listening that are that way, but it's not a specific constituency. And members of Congress are more worried about the people who say, you need to cut my taxes, you need to raise spending over here, than they are the deficit, because there's no real organized groups, very few of them, that walk in and say, you got to do something about that.
Okay, so I understand exactly what you're saying. I could have called Shohei Ohtani and placed a good sized bet that would be your rationale for why you would be against these bills. Here's my counter to it, and this is an impossible question to answer, but just maybe whether my premise is a decent premise or not. The premise is the national security interests of the United States are precarious enough in the Middle East, with Eastern Europe, with the CHICOMs and the Indo-PACOM, that the aid money, the upside to our national security interests by the aid money going out, regardless of whether it's a pay for or not, and I'm with you on the pay for stuff, I truly am, but the upside to our national security interests far outweigh what the implications would be if we withheld the money on principle because there's no pay for and saw all three of those areas potentially spiral into a more negative negative future for the United States on the world stage. Does that make you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I understand. Because basically it's like, you know, when you were in World War II, you didn't worry about the deficit, right? You fought the war.
And we're going to figure that out later. You got to make stuff.
You don't worry about the deficit. You
do what you got to do.
War. Now I understand. I know what you're going to say, and I'll give your argument of mine. We're not in a shooting war right now. We aren't. Other people are.
But the money's going to help keep us from having to get to that point.
Okay, I get that. But we have got to stop weakening this country from within. And the more debt we pile on, the more we weaken this country from within, the more we make it more difficult for us to do something with this all in the future. And when and where does it all end, you know? What is the end game in Israel?
Victory.
Don't know.
Defeat of Hamas.
Of Hamas? What about Iran? What about Hezbollah? What about the Houthis?
Everybody that's a threat to the state of Israel is also eventually a threat to us. The defeat of terrorist groups.
I understand in Taiwan, the end game. The goal at this point is to have it strong enough that they don't attack. But what is the end game in Ukraine?
The end game in Ukraine is to feed Ukraine so that Russia does not become more expansionist. If that goes on and is at least status and Russia can't do anything else and it eventually bleeds them dry, I'm perfectly fine with that. But if you pull back on the pedal now and Russia now gets the upper hand and eventually consumes Ukraine, then what's going to stop them from going to the next place? By keeping them bottled up in Ukraine, we're not losing any assets. We're not losing any American treasure as far as personnel in this process. All we're doing is we are bottling up Russia in a quagmire. I see very little downside to that.
Okay. Now, let me say one thing on the pay-fors. I've read some indications, I don't know, somewhere, that the TikTok ban, which is just, as you said, just changing the date they have to sell. It's not a ban. We need to stop that.
It's a forced divestiture of the CCP.
And there was a lot of information out today from Politico, of all places, that the CCP was actually lobbying members, staffs of members of Congress.
Directly, yes.
The CCP, directly. They usually use proxies to do this stuff. They usually send somebody that's a constituent, but who is
or honeypots to Eric Swalwell, but I digress.
They usually send those people into your office. I mean, it's amazing the number of people I had who were American, whatever, name your other country, that would come in advocating to me for what that country wanted the U.S. to do relative to that country right now. But for the CCP to actually lobby directly shows you how important this damn thing is to them. So it's all the more reason that we should force them to divest, and that hopefully this I would vote for. I would vote for the TikTok divestiture, and hopefully the Senate passes it and we force them to divest. Now, one thing in there, it's not clear to me if it's in there or not, but there's been all this talk about seizing these Russian assets that were frozen after the invasion of Ukraine. I am not a big fan of that. I think we have to be careful about when we are not directly in a war with someone else, where there's American troops being shot at and shooting at another country's troops, that to be not just freezing assets, but actually seizing them. So one thing I saw was that maybe this was part of the pay for the other things, is we're going to seize these Russian assets and we're going to use them to pay for the money for Ukraine and the money for Israel and the money for Taiwan. Okay, well, that would solve my pay-for problem, except that I don't know that's a place we want to go down right now. We already have a lot of countries pulling away from the dollar as the reserve currency because of the fact that we took Ukraine or Russia's treasury assets, and effectively we seized them. We said, yeah, you have treasury bills. Guess what? We're not paying them back. And so we actually already did some of that. And as a result, a lot of other countries dumped their treasury bills because they're like, how do you know Joe Biden won't say, wait a minute, you don't respect transgender rights, so we're going to seize your treasury bills. So one of the things as we look at all this stuff is to consider the long-term consequences of this thing. And I know that's what you're doing. You're saying the long-term consequences is we could be in a shooting war with Russia and NATO. We could be in a shooting war with
Iran. Middle East.
In the Middle East, if they attack some of our bases. We could be a shooting war with China and Taiwan. I understand that. And that's the what you're looking towards looking forward. But I'm also looking at our fiscal and financial situation because in a lot of ways, we beat the Soviet Union with money because we ran them out of money. And they, in the end, weren't able to compete with us financially. We may be in a situation where we run ourselves out of money and we can't compete with China financially if we're not, or some of these other countries, if we're not careful. So
I appreciate that argument. I guess what I look at is the political landscape right now, and I understand the principle. It seems to me as somewhat tilting at windmills-ish because if you did pay for it, like you said, it's never going to go anywhere. And now what you would have is a situation where four more bills of actual functioning of the Congress get defeated. It's a failed Congress at that point. People now pull back from both sides saying nobody can get anything done. And the chance of actually trying to increase your numbers in the fall so that you can actually have more principled-based votes, if you've got the Senate under control, if you've got the House under control, and possibly a Republican president, you can't actually have the landscape that you want to be able to fight this pay-for a battle on unless you increase your numbers. If you are feckless and can't do anything, you're not making any case to the American people that you can actually be trusted with governing, right? It's kind of a catch-22.
Because this is a podcast and not a video cast, people couldn't see that I was nodding as you said that. Because the political aspects of this, every bill has a policy aspect and a political aspect. As I said, I think Speaker Johnson wants these policies to pass. He's with you.
He's got to show they're doing something.
He believes we need to do this. But the political aspect is just what you said, that if these don't pass, then Biden is out there running around during this election, saying the
beating Republicans over the Republican head with a brick.
Congress is making the world unsafe. Is, you know, won't even help our allies in Israel. Won't help humanitarian aid. Won't help Ukraine. You won't help Taiwan against China. And he would beat us over the head with that. And so would Democrats. So there's a political win for Johnson on this. There's also one for Biden though, because this when Congress and Washington doesn't work, yes, it affects Congress, but it affects the president more than anybody. And if everyone knows that Ukraine is a huge priority for the president, maybe because of the money Hunter got from Ukraine, to think that that's not part of it would be naive in my view. That is definitely part of it. But this will be a big win for him. And he will run out and say this is a big win. And the other thing I think he's hoping it does is he doesn't want the Treasury market to collapse before November. He doesn't want the economy to collapse before November. He doesn't want inflation going back to 6% or unemployment going up to 5% before November. He also doesn't want any one of these three erupting into a bigger, hotter war before November. And my guess is, if this passes, and I think it will, that then his next chat with Netanyahu is, hey, dude, and I'm not agreeing with Biden on this. I'm just saying this is what he's going to say. He's going to say, hey, dude, I just sent you $28 billion. You can't attack Iran. And I think that may be it won't be in the bill because I think Republicans would push back against it. But my guess is that it's a wink and a nod thing, which is something Mr. Hewitt probably won't like. But anyway, it's a win for both the House Republicans and potentially the Senate Republicans to vote for, and for Biden. in most cases.
And that's possibly the case if Joe Biden tries to attach strings to the money in a conversation with Netanyahu. If I'm Netanyahu, I say thanks for the money, Mr. President. Good words. Go do what they still are going to do what they have to do. If they've got to attack Rafah, if they've got to attack Hezbollah, if they've got to attack Iran, they're still going to do what they got to do. And what's Joe Biden going to do at that point? Then go back and retroactively put in sanctions 3 months before an election? Of course he's not. I mean, it goes both ways. I mean, Netanyahu's been around this block a few times, too. He's going to push back on that kind of stuff and say, you don't have the stones to be able to do anything to us directly punitive 3 months in front of an election.
Yeah. So when this $100 billion new bonds, treasury bonds get issued, you going to buy some to pay for this?
I'm sure my retirement fund's going to have something in it. Right.
Anyway, it's just, yeah, it just means.
I don't think we're going to be on a playing field that is conducive to that argument until you make wins, and you can't get wins unless you put something on the board along the way.
I think we're going to be talking about this again next week.
I think so too.
Let's over the weekend or whatever. So we have to talk about Speaker Johnson, though.
Yes, we got to talk about Speaker Johnson because these votes are not being conducted in a vacuum. There is the knucklehead caucus that threw out Kevin McCarthy a few months ago are back, and they are not happy. They are not happy for a myriad of reasons. Marjorie Taylor Greene filed a motion to vacate. One of the things that led to Kevin McCarthy's downfall in his desire to become speaker, he basically gave away the ability to have that office have any meaningful power. And one person can file a motion, and was it three people can force?
Well, Thomas Massie was one of them. I served with him. I know him.
Right.
He's a purist, and which I object to, because I just don't think in a democracy you can be a purist. You can in an authoritarian government, but
the founding fathers learned very quickly that you can't have purism because it doesn't work in a representative republic. It just doesn't.
Right. It just doesn't. But he's not a nut, and he's everything he wants, I want, pretty much. And he joined MTG on this. I don't think he voted oust McCarthy. I don't think. I can't remember
I'm not sure if he was one of the ones or not, but he was making claims this week saying that when they finally hold their motion to vacate, that Mike Johnson wouldn't even get the same amount of votes to save his job that Kevin McCarthy would. It's all bluster. It's all talk. It is not helpful. It's dumb tactics at this point by the Republicans.
And the speaker has said very clearly, he said, hey, we've got to govern. I've got to do what we've got to do to govern. And what happens on the speakership happens on the speakership. So we may go through this again. And by the way, if we do, then whatever political win the House had from passing this thing will be gone. To a large degree, even if, and as we know, right now, there's only a one seat majority. So with those three people, he's already gone. I mean,
yep.
He's gone.
And you do two things. One, you basically give the tail end of the year, you basically have a functioning House with Hakeem Jeffries as the de facto speaker. And number two, you have Joe Biden being able to campaign for the rest of the cycle, looking at the Republicans saying, look at the disarray over there.
And
we're giving him that argument.
I said I'd vote against the bills, but I would not vote against the speaker because there are lots of bills that speakers put on the floor in my 10 years there and that I voted no on. I'm a Republican speaker, Democrat. I voted no on almost all of them, but Republican speaker put on the floor I didn't know on. And I would voice my displeasure, but I didn't think we removed the speaker because it's like anything else. If you want to then run for speaker. You know, if you don't like the speaker and you think it's that bad, then you run.
Nobody wants that job right now.
Nobody wants that job. No, not with a one seat or whatever majority and everything that's going on with it. It's a tough job anyway, all the time. So it's, but anyway, that's another aspect of these bills going on the floor is that we may have another speaker fight. And if we do, we will be talking about it in the Look Through the Chaos podcast. So next topic.
Next topic. We want to talk a little bit. In fact, let's do some California news quickly, and then we'll jump back to more national stuff. Let's play the sub theme for our California news. This would be John Hyatt.
So adios to California. Nothing to do but turn around. I always thought there's someone coming for you.
So in California, I've got a bunch of things I could bring to the table here, but there's only two stories I really want to focus on because I don't want to completely eat up the rest of the show with this. SB 1403, authored by State Senator Stephen Bradford of Gardenia, would establish the California American Freedmen Affairs Agency. This would be a brand new statewide agency that's basically a California genealogy office. The bill would direct the CAFA to implement suggestions from the state's Reparations Task Force, a body created by the state legislature, which recommended that eligible Black residents of California could be owed up to $1.2 million, according to CalMatters. So we're going to set up an agency to test the blood purity content of and investigate the records of everybody trying to make reparations claims to say, well, you've got this amount of African-American blood in you, so you get this amount of money, John. I'm sure nothing's going to go wrong with this, right?
No. And what's interesting, Kamala Harris won't get anything.
No, because she's half Jamaican and half...
Indian.
Indian, right?
Indian. Yeah, half Indian and half Jamaican. But and not Indian... Indian from India,
right.
Not American Indian. Yeah. So, I think what this is, you know, they passed this thing and Gavin Newsom.
Ha, it finally happened to you.
There
now,
it is. Yeah.
Now,
I surprised Harley.
Now, Harley, he knows where this is coming from. If I say Gavin Newsom, it's going to be, see, he hoes me too.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks a lot, Harley. Thanks a lot.
But anyway, Gavin was all for this thing, and because he's all for all this kind of stuff because he thinks it's popular. And then they came out with that $1.2 million per person thing that would eat up like 3 years of California's total budget.
Yes.
Like all of it.
Yes.
For 3 years, all of it to send this out. So he realized that was a problem. So he started to backpedal. The left was ripping on him. So I think what this is this is, they have a deficit. You may have noticed. We've talked about it. It's almost $100 billion. They found it's 78, 80 something billion. They found $17 billion, which was all gimmicks and move things around. I read the other day of the $17 billion they found, only like $3 or $4 billion of it is an actual cut. The rest is just spreading out spending. It was supposed to be done over 2 years.
It's kicking the can down the road. It's wallpapering the state with IOUs. We'll make this payment later. We'll defer the payments.
They're just moving it out. But the point is, adding another new, brand new out of the box, coming from nowhere with no revenue attached to it, expense, is just not, as Austin Powers would say, it's just not in the cards, baby. But that was a terrible Austin Powers, wasn't it?
That really was. He would have been better doing that as Cartman.
Anyway, so I think what this is, all right, we're working on it. Here we go. This is the next stage. This is the next step. We can't be giving it to everybody. We need to see. So what he's doing is he's stalling. He's stalling for time until he's out of office or is president of the United States, which is what actually he wants. So that's
right.
What this is, I think.
Okay. Second and last California-based story. Karen Bass, the mayor of Los Angeles.
Who I serve with in the legislature and in Congress. So I
know
her
pretty well. That's exactly
very
right.
Well.
She gave... something that Gavin Newsom couldn't give. Gavin Newsom has still yet to give the State of the State address, right?
That's right. He has not.
Karen Bass gave the State of the City address this last week. And in her address to the fine Angelenos, she is begging, pleading, beseeching the most wealthy that are left in Los Angeles to help join the city and fund the homeless camps all over the city. She is begging the private sector, we will not hide people, but what we will do is house people. She is begging that the most fortunate in the city help fund the housing for the homeless as part of a new strategy to tackle the homeless crisis in her State of the City. Yeah, that's going to go over really well. I'm sure every actor in Brentwood and Malibu is going to say, yep, you betcha. Here are millions of dollars. Go ahead and put them in hotels. Let's house all these people.
Well, she'll go to Hollywood, the studios, you know, to the Disney and Paramount and some of those and see what she can get, I suppose. But I thought you were going to say that she's proposing an income tax like New York City has.
No, she's doing a fundraising thing to basically beg and plead and pull the heartstrings to go after the 1% and take more.
Yeah, well, that's I would be stunned if they don't move towards an income tax like New York City has. In New York City, you pay a city income tax in addition to your federal and state income tax. And so wouldn't L.A. is the second biggest city in the country?
Yep.
Why shouldn't they have it? That would not surprise me at all. And by the way, it's all this kind of, I tweeted out yesterday or day before, you may have seen the restaurant someone else tweeted out that I forwarded that is now including a 4.6%, I think it was.
Security fee tax.
Because they have to have private security because there's so much crime. So that
you don't get mugged at the restaurant.
On your way in, on your way out. And they can't count on the police to do that because the cops are busy, finding people who are using the wrong pronouns and stuff like that. So they don't do that. So they had to hire security and they're putting a tax on your bill for security.
I'm in full agreement with you here. I think LA is going to eventually move to a citywide tax.
Yeah.
And Karen Bass, if she's still mayor at that point, she will point back to this and saying, I tried to do this the easy way.
Voluntarily.
But all you deadbeats didn't do it the easy way. So now we have to do it the hard way. We're just going to take it.
Yep. And as crappy as the city of my birth, Los Angeles, and where I was not only born, but also raised is today, there's a ton of 10, 20, 40, $100 million houses there that seem to be selling. Now, the thing is, an awful lot of them these days are going to be second home. I mean, if you buy a $50 million home, I'm sure it doesn't have to be your primary residence.
Right.
You can afford another house somewhere else. So so maybe they won't be, but there's still an awful lot of money in Los Angeles. So that's what she's talking about going after.
Yeah. Okay, let's get back to national stuff. I wanted to cover the issue of the Trump trial, but in the overall context of what Alvin Bragg is trying to piece together as far as a legal theory and what's actually being done to Trump compared to any other American. And you had some thoughts about the two-tiered system of justice. Now, the interesting thing about this argument is that people on the left think that Trump's getting it too easy because of a two-tiered system of justice. They're actually trying to make the reversed argument, which is absolute lunacy to me. But you've got some thoughts on what we're seeing, we as conservatives, and it doesn't matter if you like Trump or not. There is a two-tiered system of justice, John.
Yeah, because Bragg is there's a lot of legal scholars, I certainly am not one, that think that there's no crime here at all. But even if there is a crime, it's a misdemeanor, and he's elevated it to a felony. At the same time, he's taken hundreds of felonies, violent felonies, many of them, and reduced them to misdemeanors because those were illegal aliens or whatever they were. So why is it this particular crime gets elevated from a misdemeanor to a felony when all these others, hundreds of them, felonies get reduced to get put the other way? It's a total two-tiered system. You look at the people who blocked the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, who I believe are all free now. And
did you see the story about that, by the way? The story about
maybe
that?
I didn't. What is it?
Act Blue is stepping in, and they are providing the bail money for all these people to get them out. And Act Blue is raising money off of that. And they're pocketing some of these as operating expense. They're actually using all these protests as a fundraiser for Act Blue.
Yeah. So you block the Golden Gate Bridge, you block the road to O'Hare Airport, to Seattle Airport, to all these different places.
Brooklyn Bridge.
And in many cases, you don't get arrested. If you do, it's a misdemeanor. Even that, they let you out. They let you out with bail or no bail. But if you block an abortion clinic, which isn't quite the same, I don't think, as the Golden Gate Bridge in terms of its impact, you go to jail for like 10 years. Or if you sit in front of that abortion clinic and pray, you don't even block it. But simply because you're there praying, some people are offended by your prayers and don't want to walk past, you also go to jail. This stuff is the two-tier system. And, oh, what's his name? The guy who was basically a good Samaritan on the subway, and now he's getting charged with a
crime for 10 or 15 years.
Yeah. And they do that. But then an actual guy who comes in and beats up people on the same subway is out on no bail. So it's there is a two-tiered system. And the thing is you have to look, okay, we look places you want to go, places you don't want to go. Nobody wants to go someplace that's unsafe. One of the things we look about that's unsafe is crime. And so I think Seattle, Portland, Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, these are all unsafe cities. Philadelphia, probably.
Philly, for sure.
These are all unsafe cities. But there's another element of lack of safety, particularly if you are a conservative or you are a Christian or you are a Jew. Any of those things. And if the system of justice is bad in that city and bad in that state, and we also know it's bad federally now, they could arrest you for using the wrong pronoun. They could arrest you for praying. They could arrest you for all kinds of things. And in fact, they are. And so, and I know we're going to talk about the J6 people here in a minute as another indication of a dual standard of justice. But another reason I wouldn't go to New York City is what if they decided, what if I was arguing with somebody about politics or something, or said I'm a supporter of the Second Amendment, or had a Confederate flag, God forbid, or anything like that, and they decide to put me in jail, the city would do that, the state won't rescue me, and the federal government won't rescue me. The same is true in Portland. The same would be true in Chicago. Now, there's some places, if you're in Austin, Texas is a very left city that has terrible,
as I understand it. But the state overall ain't going to put up with that.
No, the state's not going to put up for that, and they may rescue you. So that may not happen to you in a blue city in a red state. And it may not happen to you in a red city in a blue state. But it certainly is going to happen to you in a blue city in a blue state. And I'm frankly going to avoid those. I just don't want to go to those places because there is political prosecution. These are political prosecutions. Call it, there's no other term for it. It's a total, you are going to jail for your political beliefs. I know that my political beliefs are jailworthy in Oregon and in Washington or where now where you are in Orange County, California. I don't know, the cities are different. Some cities are left, some are not. But Orange County is pretty conservative.
It's pretty conservative.
And so the state would go after you, but I think you'd be protected in Orange County from the state. But if you're in LA, that's not going to happen. If you're in San Francisco, that's not going to happen. Frankly, I think maybe if you're in San Diego, that's not going to happen.
Sorry, you're itching to
say something.
No, that's fine. The point of the matter of the two-tier justice system is part of the galvanization of support behind Donald Trump is not because of Trump's magnetic personality. It's because people see he is being the subject of a two-tiered system of justice and nobody likes it. And that's regardless of what you think about Trump the man, but they know he's being railroaded and people like that instinctively.
It's not true that nobody likes it. The left loves it.
Well, I understand the left loves it, but people that... independents, people in the middle, people that would have been shying away from Trump, they're starting to kind of come back home because they're seeing what's going on in what an authoritarian state could look like, and they don't like it.
Right, because if it can happen to him, it can happen to me.
It can happen to anybody. That's part of the reason a lot of black support is coming to Donald Trump because they're saying, yeah, that's the kind of stuff that happens to me. Now, at the Supreme Court this week, in the Fisher v. United States oral argument, the Solicitor General is making a case about process and how the statute can be interpreted this way, but it can't be interpreted that way. And she's completely trying to wallpaper the the Supreme Court on this, and Neil Gorsuch steps in and dropped in a couple of hypotheticals, which were tremendous.
So let me respond to that in two ways. I do want to have a chance to address any concerns about breadth, but the more fundamental point, I think, is that I don't even understand petitioner to be suggesting that you can mix and match the verbs and the nouns from C1 and C2 in this way. Judge Nichols had a more limited view that C2 exclusively focuses on physical objects. It wouldn't apply to things like testimony because of the limitation that he gleaned from C1. Judge Katsas, I think, maybe in line with your question, would interpret it more broadly. And the basic point as a textual matter is that there is nothing in the text of C2 itself to disclose what the relevant similarity from C1 ought to be. Instead, we think the relevant similarity is obstruction of an official proceeding, because that's the language Congress chose.
General, if that's the case, what work does authorized do on your theory? Because I think I might, as I'm hearing you, think that whoever corruptly obstructs, influences, or impedes any official proceeding or attempts to do so stands alone. And the otherwise, I'm not hearing what work it does. Can you explain to me what work it does on your view?
Yes. So the work that otherwise does is to set up the relationship between C1 and C2 and make clear that C2 does not cover the conduct that's encompassed by C1. Now, I acknowledge that there
would be... Beyond saying, okay, C1 does some things, and the whole rest of the universe of obstructing, impeding, or influencing is conducted by C2. Is that a fair summary of your view?
Yes, but there was a good reason for Congress to do it this way.
Oh,
it traces
understand.
To the statutory history.
I understand that.
I would just say, if I might.
So what does that mean for the breadth of this statute? Would a sit-in that disrupts a trial or access to a federal courthouse qualify? Would a heckler in today's audience qualify, or at the State of the Union address? Would pulling a fire alarm before a vote qualify for 20 years in federal prison?
Oh, see, he went there, John Campbell. He incited the Jamal Bowman stunt. It was he gets it. I mean, Neil Gorsuch gets it. There is a specific level of partisanship that's being applied to how they are implementing these laws, right? There is a two-tiered system of how it's going on. And the hypothetical that Justice cited is not a hypothetical at all. It's real world.
And Jamal, he was given a misdemeanor, just slap on the hand, didn't affect anything. Are there 300 plus, I believe, people from January 6th, many of whom were just standing there? There's
right.
No evidence that they did anything bad to anybody, broke anything, did anything at all, that are in jail. Many of them without charges, almost all of them without bail. And
right.
So it's, again, a political, they are political prisoners. If someone broke something, committed violence, okay, that's different. And some of them did, I'm sure. But for the vast majority of them, they're political prisoners. But if you're on the left and you do something similar and disrupt a proceeding, well, then we let that out. And this is what the neo-Marxist left wants. This is what authoritarian governments do. It's very simple. And they create crimes. It's what the whole hate crime and all this stuff, which I have voted against every single thing that involved with hate crime and so forth. Because it's all about you have a crime that is greater because of your thinking, you know, because of what you're thinking. Now, I understand there's intent to kill and not intent to kill in a murder and so forth. So there's some places where perhaps that is relevant. But we're talking about here where basically your political positioning makes the difference between you, whether you go to jail or not on something. And neo-Marxists are fine with that, because that political positioning is a hate crime in their view. Oh, you believe in the Constitution? That is a hate crime. You believe in the Second Amendment? That is a hate crime. You don't call somebody by their preferred pronoun? That is a hate crime. You think that people who are transgender have a dysfunction that is not something to be celebrated? That is a hate crime. So...
Two very quick stories to wrap things up for today. And they both are kind of related in that we're talking about neo-Marxists and just the glory that is fun to take in the response to and watching them squirm. I know this will bring a smile to your face. Two stories. One, at our friends, the Googles, their corporate offices in California, New York, there was some anti-Israel sit-ins at the corporate offices by Google employees. The employees of the Googles don't like the fact that the Googles are not anti-Jew enough, and so they are staging sit-ins. And you'll be surprised to learn, John, that the heads of the Googles are not happy about that. They don't like this protesting activity that's going on. Meanwhile, over at NPR, their brand new CEO is running into one, reality, and two, Christopher Rufo, who is doing a number on her. And John, it's kind of hard not to just kind of smile at the comeuppance going on at NPR and Google.
It is. We'll see what happens if Christopher Rufo is going to be as successful at NPR as he was with the president of Harvard, and we shall see. I think the main thing he's calling for right now, and by the way, I'm about three quarters of the way through his book on, which is really good, on how the left has won the culture. And the last bit will be some of the things that he believes we need to do to turn the tide. But this is amongst them, is pointing it out. This woman at NPR, you can't make this stuff up. Oh my.
She's out of central casting. She's neo-Marxist central casting.
If I came on this show and read her stuff, but didn't tell you it was hers, and said, this is the sort of thing somebody on the left, all of you left does, all you people listening would say, oh, Campbell, you are making that up. Oh, come on. That nobody does that. Not even the most wacko left person says stuff like that. Oh my gosh, she's amazing. And by the way, did you notice before this, her job before NPR? She ran Wikipedia.
Of course she did.
Yeah. So anybody thinks they get Wikipedia has me with a third kid, which the captivating Mrs. Campbell is often talks about this third kid on my Wikipedia page, whose name apparently is Isaac. And she said, well, you never told me about this third child that you had apparently with somebody else. But Wikipedia does stuff like that. That's unbelievable. And the Googles, I just have to love it when you're not left enough, when you are so far left that it's still not left enough, because you have to be pro Hamas now. If you're for every other stupid neo-Marxist left-wing thing there is, but you don't celebrate October 7th, then you're not left enough.
It's fun to behold. Anyway, with that kind of wraps up this edition of Look Through the Chaos. So much left on the tables, a whole bunch we could have done. I could have spent half an hour on Joe Biden's trip to Pittsburgh talking about his ancestry, which was just a crazy maker. But we'll see where the news goes next time. For John Campbell, at Look Through Chaos on Twitter. For Dwayne Patterson, that would be me, at Radio Blogger on Twitter X. Read us at Look Through the Chaos and join us next time. Thanks, everybody. Have a great weekend. Bye.